This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Wittertainment ahoy, as they say. Mark is in Cannes.
Who actually says Wittertainment ahoy? Who ever actually says that?
Probably nobody. Okay. It's just occurred to me something to say.
Okay, but I think we should all from now on say Wittertainment ahoy. I have to tell you, incidentally, I was walking down the Croisette in Cannes yesterday and somebody came up and shook me by the hand and said, love the show, Steve.
which is terrific. What was that noise?
We're in Radio France and there's an awful lot of noise going on everywhere.
Right, oh, that's a squeaky door. I thought it was someone, you know, squeaking a balloon or something like that.
What that was, hilariously, was that was somebody coming from the next studio, banging on our studio door to tell us to keep it down because they're on air live.
As opposed
to...
I feel
I should send Stephen out to explain to them that they're not the only people here.
And that's the Promenade... is it the Promenade La Croisette or Promenade de la Croisette?
Well, yeah, it's the Croisette to everyone, the croissant to those of us. Basically, there is a large croissant. Yeah, there's a story about why it was that the French invented croissants. Did you know that? It's a story that, in
fact, it's got nothing to do with the croisette, though, has it?
Yeah, because a croisette and
a
croissant,
small cross.
It's a crescent, no, surely.
A croisette is a small cross.
No, it must be the case. Well, the
croissant might be a crescent, but
the croisette is not shaped like a small cross. It is shaped more like a croissant or indeed a crescent. It is the great big semicircular bit of beach that runs along the seafront at Cannes. And what you have at one end of it is you have a building, the Palais, which is referred to in common parlance as the bunker. And I am downstairs in the bunker at what is the sort of nerve centre of the Cannes Film Festival. So all around me, all the sort of the rest of the festival is kicking off and happening, but we are downstairs in the bunker.
And amongst the headline-grabbing movies, I should say, by the way, David Cameron's he's in Edinburgh and he's visiting the Scottish Parliament. We'll hear some of that.
I thought you were about to say David Cameron is in Cannes.
No, I don't think he'll get round to that, but he's got other alliances to build first before he can be bothered with the French, shall we say.
Yes,
He's seen Robin Hood.
He's seen Robin Hood.
And he knows that the French are at the heart of all evil in the world.
And we should point out, to just remind people, that Russell Crowe did say when he came on our programme, Confrontation, a couple of weeks ago, that he had said to Ridley Scott, do you think the French who've booked Robin Hood as the opening night movie in Cannes have actually seen it and do realise that all the baddies in the movie are indeed French? Because I was here the year that Marie Antoinette played, which was the subject of much French political booing, because at the end of the movie she doesn't get her head cut off.
Well, what do they know? So
exactly.
apart from Robin Hood, what else is grabbing the attention?
Well, they had the first press screening this morning of Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, which I will review later on in this hour. So that was the big scrum news story coming up here this morning. Because you have to remember, in Cannes, all the press screenings start, you know, very first thing in the morning, and then they build up to the red carpet screening, which is later on in the evening. So all the red carpet stuff for that will be happening later on. Right now, at the moment, somewhere in this building, Oliver Stone is doing a press conference with Michael Douglas. So there's flash bulbs going off outside. They are currently talking the movie up. So we saw it first thing in the morning. Then it will get its preview, its proper red carpet premiere later tonight.
We're talking movies between now and 4 o'clock. And Mark is in Cannes. Just a word on whether you hate it as much as ever, because you sounded quite joyful and quite ebullient when we spoke to you earlier, or were you just pretending?
No. Well, I mean, I've only been here for... Because I left Southampton at 3 o'clock yesterday. What day? It's Friday today. 3 o'clock yesterday. And then I had the classic Cannes thing of I got here, I got my pass, I saw 4 movies. But the first movie I went in to see was the wrong movie. I thought I was going to see a documentary about Silvio Berlusconi, and it wasn't until the lights went down that I realised that, in fact, I was watching a strange Portuguese ghost story and were not a documentary about Silvio Berlusconi. But that is the classic Cannes experience. You roll with the punches, basically. So this is now halfway through the second day, and after I've finished here, then there's another 2 screenings to do. So at the moment, I'm in pretty good shape. However, my mood has just been completely flattened by the fact that I now have to say words which don't come easily to me. Simon, you are right. According to this, the Croisette does indeed mean the Avenue of the Little Cross. So despite the fact that I've been coming to this place for 12 or so years, always believing that Croisette was so named because it looked like a croissant, it turns out that even that's not right. But I haven't seen the Leopard Ladies yet. I think they've stopped coming. There was a pair of women who for ages and ages, you weren't at Cannes until you'd seen the Leopard Ladies. Who were these women? I think they were a mother and daughter, and they just wandered up and down the Croisette dressed as leopards for reasons best known only to themselves.
Yeah, lots of Robin Hood conversation later in the programme. Nick Proctor in Wellington, New Zealand.
Yes.
Maybe you can explain his opening, actually. He says, dear Russ LaRock and 30-odd Foot of Grunts.
Yeah, well, that's Russell Crowe's band is called 30-odd Foot of Grunts, isn't it?
And Russ LaRock?
Russ LaRock? Well, I mean, I must mean
that
Russ
must be
the Rocker.
Crow.
That basically, no, yeah, exactly.
The
as it,
okay.
Oh, the Oh, I see. Very good.
Anyway, really enjoyed your interview with Russell Crowe. He says, still, although he gave an apparently well-informed critique of Robin Hood in the cinema, he is mistaken in thinking that this most recent version is the first revisionist take on the legend. Robin and Marian, which starred Sean Connery as Robin, yes, and Audrey Blumen Hepburn as Marian, was directed by Richard Lester, also begins with the death of Richard the Lionheart, played by Richard Harris.
That's
clever
right,
fellow death is, says Richard, just before he croaks. Richard, of course, overacting even whilst lying down with an arrow sticking out of his neck. Robert Shaw is the Sheriff of Nottingham. Nicol Williamson is Little John. I also seem to remember that Ronnie Barker plays Friar Tuck.
I don't remember that. Is
no,
that right?
That can't be right. Anyway,
no.
Nick says, I live in Wellington, New Zealand, the city where Russell, although a naturalised Australian, was born. This is why he can be known locally as Academy Award-winning Kiwi actor Russell Crowe and Australian bad boy actor and national embarrassment Russell Crowe, depending on what he's been up to in his spare time with telephones and whatnot. I'm really looking forward to seeing the new movie, which will hopefully finally heal the trauma inflicted by the pile of horse apples that was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and that blooming awful song. Keep up the good work, everything I do, and so on, says Nick Proctor.
Well, we are going to do a full review of Robin Hood, and as far as I understand, it's going to be a full all-singing, all-dancing review of Robin Hood, including an intervention from Radio 4's very own Mark Lawson.
Yes, that's
Is
right.
Is that correct?
Whose interview with the sainted Crow didn't go quite as strongly. Well, basically, yes, he took exception because there was a line of questioning about Mr. Crow's accent,
yes,
which I had thought of going down, but then when he started beating up on you, I thought, let's just leave it there.
Yeah, it was interesting. I did notice how the minute that Russell Crowe, albeit as a case of mistaken identity and wrongly, started beating me up on air, you just stood back and watched.
Yes.
You didn't intervene in any way to say, all you did was occasionally prodded him to try and do it again. It was like watching some kind of blood sport. And thanks for that, Simon.
It's a pleasure. It was quite entertaining. American, the Bill Hicks story, a film by Matt Harlock and Paul Thomas, who coincidentally are here in the studio. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Hi there, Simon.
Identify yourselves as to which is which so that people can...
Hi there, okay. I'm Paul Thomas.
And I'm Matt.
Which will narrow it down. Just I think... we've got loads of people commenting about Bill Hicks, loads of people who went to see him in the early 90s, who saw him on the tour that he did in the UK, and they want to have their say about Bill Hicks. So on the one hand, he's a legend. On the other hand, people go, no idea what you're talking about. So explain who he is and why you wanted to make a film about Bill Hicks, gentlemen.
Well, Bill Hicks was an American comedian who came over to the UK and caused a storm in 1991. He won the Critics Award at Edinburgh, and there was a performance broadcast on Channel 4 called Relentless. And it was kind of a new type of approach to stand-up, which was incredibly truthful, incredibly powerful, and quite dirty as well. And he essentially, you know, converted thousands and thousands of people in the UK almost overnight. He became a sensation here. He went back to the US and never really got that kind of mainstream attention, and died tragically young of pancreatic cancer, aged just 32.
So why is it that to many comedians and many of his fans, he is an absolute legend, like a sort of untouchable, and if you criticise him, it's a bit like criticising Python, you know, you get a lot of people jumping on you, yet to an awful lot of other people, they don't really know his material at all?
Well, that's the incredible thing. I mean, there was a recent Top 100 Comedians show on TV here, and Bill came in at number 4. Now, Ricky Gervais is number 3. Everyone knows who Ricky is, and the guy right behind him, so many people have not heard of. But you're right, amongst comedy circles, he's known as the guy who shows you how it should be done, isn't he?
Mm. I mean, the amazing thing for comedians, I think, is seeing Bill's performance stagecraft. The comedians tend to, I think, look at how many hours you've done on stage, and you can see it in the confidence and in the ability. And Bill had done so many hours on stage. He was masterful with an audience, and he just had a style which rocked people to their foundations and turned ideas on their head.
So why is it we have two English guys making a film about an American legend?
I'm not sure that the Americans would have thought it was something appropriate for a feature film. It's something that is interesting. Americans never really connected with Bill, and he had opportunities to perform to them. He did Letterman a number of times, but they're always 5-minute clips, and he was clean on those shows. So he never really got the full force of Bill, whereas in the UK, they played him unedited on TV. He did an hour and 10 minutes, and he blew people away. And he always thought that the reason he connected in the UK was because he was able to be shown to the audience in the way that he wanted to present himself, unedited and full length.
And so, sorry, what we had here 15 years later is Matt had got to know the family through doing tribute nights here and had won their trust and had just kind of realised how much more material there was. What we had is when we developed this as an idea and pitched it, broadcasters here were open to the idea. And if people have been pitching it in the States, then those broadcasters have been saying no to it. So it's a case of, you know, Bill sowed the seeds 15 years ago, and 15 years later, when we present it as an idea, people are saying, yes, we want to see this.
And before Mark chips in from Cannes, just a word on the style that you've used for the film, which is sort of conventional on the one hand because you get the people who knew him best to tell the story, but you've used a kind of a what appears to me to be a new animation style. So just explain how you would describe it.
Well, yes, it's told using animated photographs. What we knew when we realised it was going to be greenlit was that, you know, this was the only chance anyone was going to have to tell Bill's story properly. And that we had to do something much more special than just conventional talking heads intermixed with clips. We knew there were hundreds and hundreds of photos of Bill through his life, and already those photos began to tell a story. But it's very hard to expect an audience to sit there for 90 minutes just watching photos on screen. So we'd seen the technique used a bit before, but realised we could develop it further and actually make it into a much more kind of in-the-round filmic technique. So it doesn't feel like you're watching a documentary. It really feels like you're inside a film watching things that are happening. And an example of that is there's a very well-known story of when Bill's young and a local comedy club had opened up in Houston. Now, their parents didn't let them go down, so they had to sneak out of their bedrooms. Now, what you would have with a conventional documentary is you would see people now in their late 40s, early 50s, describing when they were kids. What this technique lets you do is to take photographs of them from that time and then put them back into that environment. So we went and filmed, took photos of Bill's real house. So that's the real childhood home you're seeing. And you follow his journey from you know, being on the roof outside his bedroom window down into a vehicle and driving down to Houston. So you're with them the whole time. The other important thing it does is that Bill's back there. You know, if this was just talking heads, Bill would be really conspicuous by his absence. But when you're back in that photo world, Bill's there at the centre of every single scene. So it really conveys his presence through the film.
But what is really surprising is just how much stuff there is of him, not just photographs. There are cine films and there's early video footage. I mean, there's an amazing amount of footage of him before he became the Bill Hicks that we all knew here in England. I think the thing that surprised me most, and I am a big Bill Hicks fan, is seeing just how much of his life and work was recorded before he became the comedian that we now remember. Were you surprised by how much material there was?
We were, yeah. The funny thing, Mark, is that it starts with Bill's father, you know, who filmed the family, you know, constantly on Super 8. So I guess Bill was used to, from a very young age, you know, having this lens pointed at him.
Yeah. I mean, the other amazing thing was that the Houston comedians and a lot of the footage that you're talking about is kind of early performance from the you know, the very early 80s, 25-year-old, 30-year-old VHS cassettes. And what would normally happen is that the comedian would essentially take the VHS out of the back of the deck at the end of his performance. But the comedians in Houston that Bill was performing with all kind of had a sense that they were going somewhere. And so they did a lot of filming themselves. And so, yeah, we were amazed by the archive that was available. It really tells an amazing story.
The other thing that I found really surprising was knowing Bill Hicks's work from the stuff for which he became famous in England. It's the work which had a very serious purpose, because underneath all the comedy and underneath all the, you know, the obscenity and the swearing, there was a really serious moral purpose. Was actually seeing the early work in which that purpose wasn't there, in which he is basically, you know, messing around on stage, in which he's experimenting with extreme drunkenness, in which he's doing pretty much slapstick. And I was surprised by just how infantile some of that early stuff is.
I mean, the amazing thing about Bill was that, you know, he was a real sort of a connoisseur and a studier of comedy, and he really valued physical comedy. Some of his heroes were Chaplin, particularly, and Keaton. He was really good at falling over and did that quite a lot. But he was also, you know, very interested in pushing the audience. So whether he was pushing them with political ideas, whether he was pushing them with something so scabrous and so shocking that they might recoil, you know, he was always into finding what those boundaries were. And alcohol, as you say, was a big part of that.
OK, here comes a clip from American the Bill Hicks story, Bill Hicks in action.
This is called logic. It won't hurt you, it'll set you free, but we'll get to that later.
I think a lot of comics have confused being a great comic with being like Bill Hicks. Well, no. Being a great comic has to do with your inner voice matching your outer voice, and that's what Bill did. His personality on stage was just an animated extension of who he was.
So a tiny little bit of Bill Hicks, and then some people talking about Bill Hicks. We'll play another clip in just a moment, which I think has got more of his his style on stage. This is I asked this morning on Twitter to the people who get Wittertainment updates, you know, who, did anyone go see him in that tour around the UK in the early 90s? To which the answer was loads and loads of them. Mm. For example, Ray Earl. I saw Bill Hicks at Hull University in 91. One heckler left sobbing, which is true. H. Palace, I saw Bill Hicks at the Mandela Hall in Belfast in 92. The only time my sides have cramped up from pain of laughter, he enthralled everyone there. Cironi, I dragged some friends to see Bill at the Dominion Theatre in 92. We left the show bent over with crippling rib pain. Jamie, Bill Hicks' work made me rethink everything, so much so I left my government job. Seeing American on Saturday night and can't wait, which is this movie we're talking about. SC&B, I'll assume that the film a doubter, as you'll realise. I'll assume the film captured the true spirit of Hicks, obscenely overrated and smug. CVH saying, does the Bill Hicks film contain the Freebird rant, the most terrifying stand-up moment ever? Can you explain what that was and is it in?
It is.
Yeah, parts of it are in. It's not the whole thing because it goes on for quite a long time. But basically there was a famous clip, infamous clip, which is known as Bill Loses It in Chicago. He was playing at the Funny Firm and a drunk crowd was just repeatedly shouting out the sort of the buzzword of a local DJ, which he'd encourage people to shout out, which was Freebird. And they just shouted that out at live gigs. Bill just got very upset and essentially went sort of bouncing around the stage, it's essentially suggesting that the audience should kill themselves and that they were a waste of flesh and that the peon masses were essentially getting in the way of his job because as a performer he felt that he had the right to perform without being infringed upon. And it has become very famous just because it was so in your face and it was a real moment of comedy.
Was it difficult to decide which bits to include? Because presumably if you were doing the Bill Hicks greatest hits or the greatest rants, you would have put together a different selection because you were trying to tell a story, which would mean that that would be... Some people might think, I hope that particular routine is in, and they'll be disappointed.
Yeah, it's very much... It's not the best of Bill Hicks. The way every clip's... I mean, what it does, you follow the evolution of both a person and of an artist, of a comedian developing, and every clip's picked to kind of show who this person is. So you segue from the story, you've been out in the real world, and then you segue seamlessly on stage. Every clip kind of reveals a bit of who Bill is at the time, but also has to show how his material's developing. And, I mean, you've had the comments from people who saw Bill live. What the film also gives you is a feeling of what that would have been like. So you're back with a live audience watching Bill. And although it's clips interspersed with story, we've still really tried to give the feeling of a whole performance arc. So you really do go through, you know, the ups and downs of an onstage performance.
An email from Toby Jones, brackets, no, not that one. saw Bill live in concert in Oxford back in 92. Saw the new film at the London Film Festival back in October. Enjoyed an entertaining and somewhat emotional evening very much. On the subject of the British getting Hicks more than the Americans, what release plans are there for the movie in the States, or will it be a DVD campaign over there?
We are still trying so hard to get someone to take it in the States. I mean, the funny thing is, on our website, we get three times as many hits, so there is a huge American audience, but there's still a resistance from the American industry. We don't know why.
Machine Soul says... saw Hicks live, the funniest, scariest, most intense live performer I have ever seen. This one from Shunty75. They've all got strange names because these are the Twitter names. We shared a urinal pre-gig at Hull University. Had a chat. I thought he was an exchange student. 3 hours later, I was in awe. Ifstep, saw Bill Hicks at Tivoli Centre in Dublin. He was an absolute genius, the most treasured live gig ever. Robert D, a conventional name at last. Saw him at the Apollo in London, W1. He joked about dying without saying that he was a brave comic. This from AKA, saw Bill Hicks twice when he came over to the UK. Mesmerising, powerful, filthy, hilarious, thought-provoking. Andrew Lowe, to Wittertainment, saw Hicks on The Word. He ignored Terry Christian's nasal inanities and focused on charming a supermodel guest. Maybe this is a help. Chris Morell on a text. Those not familiar with Hicks, take a look at Jon Stewart and the way they take apart people like Glenn Beck, Fox News and the like. Is there anything... Would there be something to hang... there? What would Bill Hicks make of, a daft question in a way, but what do you think he'd make of the spirit of John Stewart?
Well, John Stewart, there's a great interview, which we haven't included in the film, with John Stewart looking about 12, interviewing Bill, and obviously in awe of him. And I think that one of the things that Bill did for performers was that in the late 80s and early 90s, questioning Reagan or George Bush 1 wasn't really done in public by performers in that way. Whereas Bill was relentless in Montreal, openly questioning the veracity of the war. And I think that it just gave other performers the courage to voice what they really felt. And 15 years later, as you say, the political landscape in terms of satire and comedy has changed. Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, and even Michael Moore, are getting huge audiences. I think the landscape's changed.
I think what America's found is that there are audiences for that kind of material. I think back when Bill was around, broadcasters didn't dare, but the audience has kind of put up their hands and said, we will watch this stuff in large numbers, and obviously broadcasters respond to that. And Michael Moore's a great example of that as well, that he can get funding to do very strong documentaries now, and he wouldn't have been able to back then. I think what Bill shows is that he didn't care. He went on regardless, and he was completely fearless and was going to speak his mind no matter what, whether he had the backing of broadcasters or any kind of interest. He was going to go ahead and speak the truth as he saw it.
Would I be right in saying there isn't a punchline in the film? I mean, he didn't really do punchlines, maybe it's an unfair question, but if people are expecting jokes, he didn't really do that, did he? He did observational analysis. He was a social commentator, which made people laugh. I mean, is that fair?
I think there are punchlines in the film, but I think they may be disguised in kind of ideas and the sort of whirlwind that moves around the stage, kind of whipping up energy. And the thing that Bill did, which is almost unique, I think, for him, was he had a way of taking a subject and increasing it and adding to it and changing it as it got bigger and bigger. And you can literally hear the audience go... And it's just getting more and more. It's a fascinating way of finding out where the audience's comfort zone is. And he had a real way of pushing against that.
It's also significant to say on the subject of punchlines that Bill Hicks was a comedian for whom a regular punchline was, well, kill yourself. And actually one of the routines which he says, if you're in advertising, kill yourself. And the audience laugh. Mm. And then he says, no, really,
yeah. And that's
kill yourself.
This is in the film.
Yeah, and when that's the point at which you get, is that a punchline? Is that a joke? Or is he actually being serious? And of course, the funny thing is, I think he probably is being serious.
I think he's being a bit of both. I think that he's enjoying the fact that telling a whole industry to kill itself would cause shock. But at the same time, I think that he's connecting with something deep within the audience, which is that, yeah, hang on a second, in the back of my mind, I don't like advertising very much, and it kind of lies to me. So maybe I agree with what he's saying, but he's up there saying it and doing it in a very funny way. I think it was a bit of both.
It's 5 live talking movies between now and 4 o'clock. Mark is in Cannes, and more from him in just a moment. We're talking about American, the Bill Hicks story, which opens this weekend. It's made by Matt Harlock and Paul Thomas here in the studio here. Let's give you another clip from the film. Is Bill Hicks.
What is pornography, man? No one knows. Supreme Court says pornography is any act that has no artistic merit and causes sexual thoughts. That's their definition, essentially. No artistic merit causes sexual thought. Boy, that sounds like every commercial on television, doesn't it? When I see those two twins on that Double Mint commercial, I'm not thinking of gum.
See, one of the most interesting things about the documentary, particularly considering the nature of a lot of Bill Hicks' material, is actually just how supportive his parents come across. Were you surprised by that? Because a lot of his early work, anyway, was done, it was jokes about his sort of very fractious relationship with his family. But in fact, in the documentary, his family come across as pretty much on his side.
Well, yeah, Mark, we didn't really know what to expect there at all. I mean, we'd read earlier books that painted that relationship as a very fiery one, and there was no communication at all throughout Bill's life. So we went to interview the family not really knowing what to expect. But straight away, it was obvious, just with the early stories, how much sort of love and closeness there was, and how really it was a story that goes on in every household, whether a teenager's growing up, that there are problems. Obviously, with the passage of time, things could have been sweetened, but it was very obvious that there was a very close connection throughout their lives.
And the other
there's a terribly moving reminiscence in which his mother says that he said to her, "You're much more open-minded than I ever thought you were."
Well, the thing about Bill's relationship with his mum, and obviously we get asked about that a lot because they were Southern Baptists and they were brought up in a strict household, is that it's something that comes across incredibly strongly, and it's not really this kind of sort of a warring sort of. I think she could see that he had a point, and she also saw that she believed in what she believed, and they never really were worried by Bill's routines. They were just like, oh, well, that's what he thinks. So I think that they kind of took it in their stride, really.
Some more comments here. Lee in Cardiff took a girl who had never heard of Hicks to see him at the GFT in Glasgow on a first date. Now, there's an an interesting first date. Was sure that she would never want to see me again, but she thoroughly enjoyed it, and we promptly fell in love. Chris says on this email, I saw Bill Hicks three times, twice in Edinburgh, once in Glasgow, around 91-92. To this day, the most affecting shows I ever saw. His death at such a young age was a shock, and I now find his videos difficult to watch. Tim in Nottingham, Bill Hicks was so influential in the UK that on the 10th anniversary of his death, he was remembered in the House of Commons. I can't remember that ever happening before. Gareth in Belfast, have you ever viewed the interview that Bill Hicks' mother did with David Letterman, where Letterman was apologising for the way he treated him on The Letterman Show?
An amazing, kind of unprecedented experience, really, yeah. So 15 years after Bill died, David Letterman interviewed Mary, invited her on the show to apologise for cutting Bill's 12th and final Letterman performance, which was about 3 months before he died. So
the whole performance was censored?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tricky situation for them and for the family, just because those performances were all vetted in advance. They were supposed to have been agreed, and then on the night they just kind of felt, well, it wasn't right for the show, and it became a massive cause célèbre. It was written about in a lot of press in the States, and for Bill fans, it was, until it was shown last year on the show, kind of like the sort of the Holy Grail, the sort of the missing performance.
And what was it? What was in that show? What was in that routine that made it so controversial?
It's the kind of thing that you kind of look at it now and go, well, what was the problem? I mean, he did some stuff about abortion and pro-life, which was a big issue back then in the States and still is now. He did some stuff about, sort of Jesus and the Pope. But the thing is that, obviously, within context and the way that he did it, they were so clearly jokes. And I think that he felt so frustrated because he felt that his right to express himself was kind of being denied.
Was there anything about Hicks and his work and his character that, having done the documentary, you came out of thinking, well, actually, I don't like that side of him? Because one of the things that comes up an awful lot with discussion of Bill Hicks is that there are people who think that there's an underlying misogyny in his work, I think perhaps in relation to pornography, perhaps in relation to some of the more sort of lurid routines that he does. Is there anything about what his opinions were or his work that you came out of the documentary, which is very, very supportive of Bill Hicks, you came out thinking, well, actually, that was a flaw?
I guess that the sort of the period within which Bill's working, sort of certain terms that were used at the time, would not be considered politically correct now. And obviously, Eddie Murphy was another person who came up against that with, a routine in Delirious, which he tried to withhold for a number of years. So I guess there are things about the time, the late 80s, that meant that some of the things that he said would not be considered correct to say now. I think that Bill was a real person. He wasn't a god, and he wasn't an icon. He was a real guy, and he had contradictions. So, some of the stuff that he did, I suppose you could say, was on the line of being, misogynistic, and you could also say that it was pushing the audience's buttons, and I think that's probably for everybody to decide for themselves.
We don't learn anything about his private life particularly.
Romance is the thing that's missing from the film, and we set out, with the intention of including that just as much. What we came up against was, the way the film's told is that every scene's told by the people who were there, so it's first-hand witness accounts. His first girlfriend, a long-term girlfriend, is now remarried. She's changed her name. His last girlfriend is also remarried. Bill had lots of kind of long-term, very deep relationships.
And did they not want to appear?
And they didn't want to appear. And then there's a woman called Pamela who was credited with helping to get Bill sober. She was in New York with him, and she sadly died 2 years after Bill died. So it was a case that we didn't have those first-hand witnesses available to tell the story, and other interviewees just weren't really comfortable, making those kind of suppositions. So we did set out to include it. And what happens, because you've got to get so much into this 90 minutes... We tried covering it, in other ways, but that story thread just didn't sustain itself, and we pulled it out in order to tell a better story in the other areas.
Is there anyone around now, whether British, American or whatever, who you'd say that's the closest that anyone has come to doing that kind of social observation or that kind of social critique, that kind of material that Bill Hicks used? Is there anyone around who you could point to?
I mean, I think there are people that that are sort of fairly, you know, sort of well thought of in that regard. People like Doug Stanhope, people like Lewis Black and Louis C.K. But I think that one of the things that, that Bill had was that he was about, you know, social satire and social criticism. But, you know, the number of names with which Bill is described just sort of suggests that he was taking it into a different area, philosopher and preacher. And so there's kind of an emotional and a spiritual element to what Bill did, which I think whether you have social satire as part of your armory as a comedian or not, and maybe other comics just don't have.
And the preacher element is clearly significant because there is an awful lot in his act that he has clearly learned from the fact that he did grow up in that strict religious environment. And when he is talking about things he believes in passionately, he talks about them with the zealous enthusiasm. You know, of there is a religious fervor in the act, isn't there?
Mm. I mean, he was also incredibly enamoured of all the preachers in the sort of the mid to late 80s who kind of fell one by one after scandal after scandal. And I think he really liked the power that that kind of environment and that kind of delivery could engender in an audience. I think he absolutely saw that that was something that he could use, yeah.
He was also on stage with Sam Kinison in the early years, and Sam had previously been a preacher. So I think, you know, Bill learnt a lot of that stagecraft in terms of the call and response with an audience, and just places you can take an audience and the sort of things you can do with them beyond just, you know, making them laugh.
Steve in Liverpool on this email: Bill Hicks was the greatest comic of my generation. I hope the film does him justice, though I worry it won't. The best I'm hoping for is that it brings the great man and his material to a new audience who go and seek him out. His goat boy routine in front of the right-on comedial elite in London ensured his greatness in front of an audience that he had eating out of his hand, but even then was determined to challenge them. Is there anything that you can tell us about that particular routine without getting taken off the air?
The best person probably to give feedback on that is John Lahr, the writer of the New Yorker magazine, who interviewed Bill extensively around that time, and he asked him about Goat Boy and kind of what it was, because obviously a lot of his other stuff was very political and very thoughtful, and this was much more about, you know, how disgusting can you make it. And Bill kind of felt that you know, he as you say, had the audience eating out of his hand. All the Guardian readers there were absolutely loving the anti-American stuff, and he thought, well, this is boring, and he wanted to push them, and he wanted to push himself. So that was the kind of thing that he kind of took in his stride, really. As he's on stage, you can see him reflecting and thinking, right, now I'm going to go this way. It's just really the mark of a master.
The movie is American, the Bill Hicks story. What kind of release have you got? What kind of distribution have you got, gentlemen? Is this going to be quite easy to find, or are people going to have to try, you know, travel a little bit, do you think?
Well, we're playing in every major city around the country. A couple of those cinemas are only showing it for one night at the moment. We don't know why, because, as we know, there's a huge kind of audience response out there. But we're hopeful that once people are turning up, that will spread wider.
So, yeah, we're opening in 10 screens, 5 in London, 5 around the country, and opening up to another 10 screens over the next 2 weeks. And then we've got a big one day coming up in June.
Matt and Paul, appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Dr. Paul from Derby says, "Dear Iron Man and Tin Man, I noticed that someone had defaced a Last Airbender poster in the Coming Soon spot in a local bus stop hereabouts. In tribute to Dr. K, the Last Airbender now reads The Last Hairbender, and written underneath, as Mark Kermode might say, in a world of straighteners, he was the one with the curling tongs." That's some graffiti, isn't it?
That's very good.
That's pretty
good.
You're
raising the standard of vandalism around the country.
Great show, Steve says. Dr. Paul in Derby. We are being live streamed, by the way, which is irritating to be told that now, just as two of our guests have left. So if you do watch live stream, all you can see is me with your Sonny Award.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, there is a camera here that is filming me, although it's not being live streamed. When we're finished here, they're going to fly it, dust clouds allowing, over to London, so that it can be cut into a vodcast package.
Oh, that's nice. Anyway, yeah, so this...
How does my Sonny Award look? Does it look good?
Well, it looks a bit kind of tarnished now. It's clearly been passed around, and people have had a look at it. Actually, yeah. I just noticed it says UK Station of the Year. So actually, it's not yours.
It's not, no.
It's just one of the many that are knocking around these parts.
Is that the UK Station of the Year Radio 5 Live?
It is.
Excellent.
Isn't that
from
good?
The Sonny Awards. Very good.
Exactly. You were on stage twice.
Yeah, Simon, you were on stage the second time. When Radio... We should say this is when 5 Live won the Station of the Year. There was a general indication from the head of the station that you should accompany him to, you know, up onto the podium. And you didn't take very much encouraging before leaping atop that podium. And then I hid behind you for the photo call.
I don't think you could hide behind me particularly.
I do in so many ways.
So
can I tell you about Wall Street?
Tell us about Wall Street, because there's Wall Street, old Wall Street, and there's new Wall Street, which we're looking forward to.
Yeah, so there's Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, which is playing horse competition, which means out of competition. The way that Cannes works is you have various sections. You have the competition section, which is the things that are competing for the Palme d'Or. You have a section called Uncertain Regard, the general pun about which is it's the films which are uncertainly regarded by the selection. They're not entirely sure what to do with them, so they put them in uncertain regard. And then there's horse competition, or out of competition, which is things like, for example, in this case, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. So that... The press screening was this morning at 8:30. There's the big red carpet thing going on. Well, it's kicking off even as we speak. So it's the long-awaited sequel to the 1987 Oliver Stone movie. I think we have a clip of the original. I think this is the clip of the famous speech from Wall Street from 1987.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms. Greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
So that's the defining speech of Wall Street. And I mean, I think some people would argue that that is the defining speech of, you know, that particular part of the 1980s. What you have in Wall Street Money Never Sleeps is the story picks up. Gecko's been in prison for insider trading for 8 years. He comes out of prison. There's a very funny scene in which he's given the things that he went into prison with, including a mobile phone, which in the manner of these things is, of course, the size of a large house brick. He then comes out to discover that his daughter, played by Kerry Mulligan, has completely disowned him. But his daughter has now taken up with Shia LaBeouf, who is himself a Wall Street trader, who is sort of looking for a mentor, which he kind of finds in the shape of this Josh Brolin character, who is effectively Gordon Gekko Mark II. Meanwhile, Gekko takes his old speech about greed is good and parlays it into something else, which is a book on the theme of, is greed good? And he does another speech. And the interesting thing is that in many ways, the things that are problematic about the movie are sort of summed up in the speech. There's a moment when we see him on tour, when he's doing this book tour, and he's come out of prison, and he's promoting this is greed good thing. And he does this speech, which, the thing about that original Greed is Good speech was it was an extraordinary piece of writing. It really, really cut to the bone. It was saying things that sounded completely outrageous, but at the same time making them sound somehow sensible. And it was, I think, a really fine moment. When he's doing the Is Greed Good speech, what he's essentially doing, it's a montage for a start rather than the speech. It's nothing like the killer lines that the first film had. It's much more, actually, like the character, the argument has become older, greyer, and a lot less punchy. And what the film attempts to do is to update all the sort of the ideas that were embodied in the original film in the post-crash era and say, well, has the world changed? Does the Gordon Gekko character still have any relevance? Is the Shia LaBeouf character still, you know, have the appeal of, for example, Charlie Sheen? And the problems with it are, firstly, I mean, Shia LaBeouf, I think he's better than he's been in a lot of things. Like, I liked him before in Guide to Recognising Your Saints, but I have always found him to be a bit of a kind of charisma vacuum outside of that. Kerry Mulligan is, you know, fine and impressive as always. But the whole movie, in the end, hangs on the presence of Michael Douglas, who I do think Michael Douglas is a really interesting actor. He's a really interesting screen presence. If you look at the films that he's made, whether you like them or not, if you look at things like Basic Instinct and Wall Street and, you know, Disclosure, I mean, he had a habit of, I mean, you know, way back to Cuckoo's Nest, everything, he had a habit of being involved in movies that were somehow completely of the moment and, you know, distilled arguments. They were talking point movies, and he did that really brilliantly. And during the course of this movie, you see him going from this incredibly rattled ex-con, kind of re-finding himself and becoming the Gordon Gekko character again. I think his performance is really good. The problem is that the rest of the movie struggles to keep up with him. And it was a really interesting thing watching the films. There was every time an old character came on, like Eli Wallach came on, there was like a round of applause in the auditorium because everyone felt that, oh, you know, this is a significant moment that we're revisiting. But the problem is, it's revisited in this kind of, you know, we're in a new age, things have changed, it's all shades shades of grey way. And what you lose, therefore, is you lose the attack, you lose the punch, you lose the comedic, the dark comedic heart that the first Wall Street had. And it's like Oliver Stone sort of wrestling with the world in a way which he doesn't quite understand. I mean, remember, the thing with the first Wall Street was, because Oliver Stone had made his name making war movies and making Platoon, that they described it as Oliver Stone goes to war, and then, you know, against the backdrop of Wall Street. And that sounded, oh, how extraordinary. He's done all these things about soldiers, now he's doing it about bankers. And we hadn't seen that world before, really, on screen. But we've seen it on screen so much now that there's a very strange sense of Oliver Stone not quite knowing how to parlay the power of the original film into different. Now, I don't mean by any means that it's not without merit, because every moment that Michael Douglas was on screen, I kind of enjoyed him and I enjoyed his performance, and I do like him. I do find him interesting. And there are individual things in the film which you feel, oh, that's, you know, it's the film for the modern age. It's the film that somehow encapsulates the chaos that we have now. But they are only moments. There's an awful lot of it that is baggy stuff that just doesn't quite hang together. There's an awful lot of it in which there are plot machinations that are really kind of not handled very well at all. Kerry Mulligan's character is meant to run a sort of lefty website that I never believed in. People get stitched up and, you know, and their careers are torched by strange plots going on behind the scenes, which I don't believe actually work like that. There's a bit of computer graphics to demonstrate the way that money gets zipped around the world, which looked, oddly enough, reminded me of Hackers. You remember the film that you and I liked and nobody else kind of really got a handle on?
That was a great film.
Yeah, I really like Hackers.
Johnny Lee Miller, wasn't it? Was it?
Johnny Lee Miller, that's right. And his then partner, Angelina Jolie. Directed by Ian Softley. I think that's a very fine film. But the fact of the matter is, if you're making Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, which is the 21st century version of this, you don't want to be reminding the audience of Hackers. I mean, you just don't, much as I like Hackers. So I think there are things in it that are good. Shia LaBeouf is better than I expected, although I still think he's got a long way to go to convince me that he's a really, really gripping actor. Josh Brolin, of course, is great. Michael Douglas, every minute he's on screen, it's fine, because I think that he's worth watching. But the film itself, oddly, suffers from exactly the problem that the financial institution that it's depicting suffers from, which is that whereas the film in the 1980s was, look, we're saying something outrageous, greed is good, and you could in the same way some of those Bill Hicks routines, you were wincing but laughing at the same time. Well, now it's saying, well, you know, it's all a bit complicated, and there's a plot about renewable energy, and there's a plot about, you know, this lefty website, and there's another, and it just doesn't have the teeth that it had before. It's not totally without merit by any means, but it is baggy around the edges.
Now, I think what we should do is we'll start a box office top 10, which, unless things are very surprising, we won't get anywhere near completing before 3 o'clock. We'll conclude it after 3 o'clock. We'll talk about Robin Hood and get to all the emails and correspondence, because loads of people have seen that already. So at number 10, it's Clash of the Titans. Titans will clash.
Will clash. I think we've said everything that has to be said about Clash of the Titans, don't you? Other than, you know, if you are still going to go and see it now, do go and see it in 2D and don't encourage
And
them.
Remember, they're not Titans. In fact, there are no Titans who clash.
No, that's right.
Stage.
That's right. Titans won't clash is what the tagline ought
exactly.
to be.
Exactly. Date nights at 9.
Which is funny for the first 20 minutes until it turns into the movie that it actually wants to be, which is a shame, because there is a very good, you know, 20 minutes at the beginning, which is just about the relationship between Tina Fey and Steve Carell, and I actually could have watched 90 minutes of that. But then when it gets into being sub after hours and sub into the night, it just becomes a bit dull.
The last song is at 8.
Which, you know, I know everybody thinks, you know, ought to be terrible, but really isn't terrible at all. It's, you know, it is what it is, and I quite like Smiley Virus. Sorry.
How to Train Your Dragon is number 7.
And hasn't that hung on really impressively? The interesting thing about How to Train Your Dragon was I don't think anybody expects it to be quite as enduring an animated hit as it's been. As I said, I've seen it in both 3D and 2D, and once again, the 3D is not necessary. But in the case of this particular film, the 3D bothered me less, because the film itself was good enough that it took my mind off the 3D, which does, I think, tell you everything you need to know about 3D.
Enough
if a film is really
already.
Good, you won't notice. Well, it's not enough already, because the market is still going on that way, and I, you know,
enough. And number 6, Four Lions.
I got stopped by Tony Blackburn, who told me that my views on 3D really annoyed him. Did you know that?
I've yes, because you did it at your Tony speech Blackburn. At the Sony Radio.
Yeah, but not everybody was there, Simon. I wasn't talking just to you, but to the wider listening public. Through you.
Yeah, you did mention it on Richard Bacon's programme, you know, so people might have heard it there.
Were you listening to that?
I was on it.
Oh, you were on it.
I was part of the discussion. Thanks for paying attention. backup plans at 5.
Oh, but you've started the music now.
Doesn't matter. Go on.
Well, no, I've got loads to say about backup. I mean, it's rubbish, but I'd like to say how rubbish it is after you've done the news.
Hot tub machine at 4.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to be hurried through the...
A Nightmare on Elm Street at 3.
No, you don't. You're throwing away gold here.
Fairy
Stop.
Vengeance at 2. Mark's in Cannes. Where did you want to go back to? Backup plan.
Yes, backup plan, which is completely awful. And it's one of those... I did genuinely go... I know people think that I just don't get rom-coms and that sort of thing, but I did go into it wanting to enjoy it. Because actually, I would enjoy nothing more than being able to come out of it and say, you know what? Backup Plan's actually an interesting movie and it's funny and I did laugh and, you know, I chuckled. And I had seen some other commentators saying that they thought it was quite funny, but it was a total laugh-free zone. And the awfulness of it, you know, is summed up most perfectly by this central comic mode of the little handbag dog in a wheelchair, which is, in the film's imagination, is somehow, you know, lovable and cute and all those other things, and in my view is just absolutely sums up everything that is misjudged about that film. It's awful.
Hot Tub Machine at 4.
It's not as funny as it ought to be. Hot Tub Time Machine is a really great title, and it's got John Cusack. And I kind of thought, I really want to like a film called Hot Tub Time Machine starring John Cusack, in which a bunch of guys get into a hot tub and it turns out to be a time machine. But it's nothing like it. I mean, some people have said it's like The Hangover Light. I mean, it didn't bother me as much as The Hangover. I found The Hangover a lot more obnoxious, but it's just not funny enough.
A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes,
and,
the remake.
We have many emails and many texts. Thank you for the comments here on Nightmare on Elm Street. Stuart, first of all, Stuart Hitchcock, just some of what he said. It's been a while, but today I had one of those rare moments where I simply needed to explode with anger. And here's my
Excellent.
Catharsis. The reason, the new Nightmare on Elm Street movie, I really am struggling to find a movie that has ever been less worthwhile or simply as awful. This movie demonstrates exactly why Michael Bay in the first instance and studio bosses in the second need to be shot. A Nightmare on Elm Street is devoid of chills or atmosphere. Even the deaths were uninventive. This is paint-by-numbers, cash-till-orientated movie-making. The characters have about as much depth as a Petri dish. Freddy Krueger is just not frightening. And I ended up being annoyed by the very opening credits. Is this the earliest anyone has ever been annoyed by a film? Why have the cast and producers' names written in crayon on a playground, which look quite good, and then duplicate with letters on the screen? And it's very, very boring.
It's interesting, that point about the opening credits. That's exactly right. Even in the opening credits, they can't decide what it is they're trying to do. So they do exactly that. They do the crayon writing, and then they put it up as proper titles, because it's like, even that early on, they've lost the plot.
Phil in London, someone needs to tell Mr. Bay and company that having discordant industrial piano chords suddenly bursting through the cinema speakers at deafening volume every time the monster turns up isn't scary. Annoying, yes. Scary, no. The acting was appalling. The CGI recreations of classic scenes look cheap and uninspired compared to the original, etc. Just one other comment from Rob in Reading. I love horror movies, Simon, but they don't love me, and I've lost many a sleepless night to the creature under the bed. When I saw A Nightmare on Elm Street in my early teens, it had a profound effect on me and has been my bête noire ever since. In my adult life, I've made peace with movies such as Jaws, which once terrorised me, but now enthralls and delights me with its cinematography, spot-on casting and flawless central performances. This couldn't have happened without Jaws 3, which was so laughably poor that it rendered the entire concept ridiculous and allowed me to regard the original in a new light. The willing suspension of disbelief has been compromised. So when I heard that Michael Bay was taking the sledgehammer to Freddy Krueger, I thought, great, it'll be so hopeless I won't be scared anymore. Didn't work. I got about 10 seconds into the trailer on YouTube before succumbing to goose pimples and an unshakable sense of doom. The following night, at the age of 36, and for the first time in 20 years, I slept with the lights on. This remake is clearly rubbish, but the underlying premise is so disturbing that even in vastly diluted form, I can't live with it. Is there room in the lexicon of film for the unwilling suspension of disbelief?
But that's an interesting point, which is that what's worrying them is the original idea, because the original idea of Nightmare about, you know, he'll get you in your sleep, you can't, whatever you do, don't go to sleep. The original idea, the conception of Freddy Krueger, is a scary idea. And if the Michael Bay produced remake has not entirely managed to kill that stone dead, then that is more to do with the, you know, the enduring power of the original idea than it is anything to do with any value that the Michael Bay remake may have. It's just a scary idea.
Furry Vengeance is at number two.
Which I wanted to like. I mean, I wanted to be able to say, oh, great, animals fight back, Brendan Fraser, take your kids. But it is pretty much by the numbers and not very exciting. It's interesting because it's clearly been a film that's been made in the wake of Alvin and the Chipmunks taking such a staggering amount of money and everybody realising that cute furry animals, you know, can be big money spenders. But again, it's nothing like as good as it ought to be. It's not without the occasional laugh, because there is quite a lot of animal poo jokes in it, which always gets a bit of a chuckle.
And it's Iron Man 2 at number one.
Which I like. And I mean, there are things that are structurally wrong with it. It does look like at certain points in the production they've gone back and, you know, put characters in, taken characters out. There's been quite a lot of stuff on Twitter incidentally with people saying, look, you shouldn't complain about characters just turning up briefly, because the fact of the matter is that they're setting up a story which you're not yet aware of, which is going to happen in the future installments. I do understand that. It doesn't mean that the movie has to feel fragmented. And I cited that before about Godfather 2, which has this incredible Brokeback structure. Doesn't mean that it feels fragmented. It still feels like a coherent work. Certainly there are large sections of Iron Man 2 which don't feel like that, but all the stuff at the centre of it between Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow, I think, is essentially funny. I think Mickey Rourke doing his mad Ruski accent, I mean, the fact of the matter is, his mad Russian accent is closer to what it's meant to be than perhaps some other actors appearing in major movies this week.
And for anyone who's just joined us and they're wondering why I appear to be in crystal clear quality and a sound perfect studio with nice soundproofing, but there's an awful lot of rattle where you are, just explain.
Well, I'm in Cannes. I'm in the bunker in Cannes. And what's happening here is that the bunkers in Cannes are literally, they are some microphones with in between them, I think it's Kleenex and spit for the walls. And what you can hear next door is somebody reviewing very loudly. I'm sure if we stop for a moment, we could hear what it, you mean. Honestly, you thought I was loud and ranty? This is what everyone's like in Cannes.
Now, last week you'll have heard our interview with Russell Crowe on playing the title role in Robin Hood, which is out today. In particular, you may have enjoyed Russell Crowe giving Mark a hard time over an article he didn't actually write. Try your Ridley Scott question again.
I know. Mark,
when we met,
yes.
Just give me a bit more context, because I might remember the conversation.
Well, it was like the first time we met.
He's got a quiff.
It was in a hotel in Leicester Square. You were over for the opening of Rumpa Stomper,
right.
And yeah, I had a quiff then. I had a quiff.
Who are you working for?
For the New Musical Express back then.
Absolute. That interview, right? I didn't mind the interview, but the way that was printed, I read NME as a young teenager.
No, hold
on.
You're thinking of Gavin Martin's piece in the NME.
Well, that was Rumpa Stomper.
Yeah, no. Yeah, Gavin Martin did an interview with you for the NME. I was working at the NME, but I interviewed you for Radio 5 immediately before Gavin Martin. Gavin Martin, who is an Irish guy who looks nothing like me, and I know exactly the piece you're referring to, and I will pass on to him your best wishes.
Yeah, where the headline was something like, you know, racist crow or something.
Yeah, that was not me.
That was so uncool, man, to be on by the Bible of your youth. That was just so uncle.
But I know that it all came right because you had such a great experience with the Radio 5 interviewer beforehand, Russell. If you remember that, I was the other guy. I was the guy you don't remember.
At this point, I'm imagining Mark running for all his life with Russell with a quiver full of arrows, and he pulls one out and he puts it in
and
his bow.
Straight in the ass.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's a little bit from last week with Russell Crowe.
You're enjoying that far too much, Simon.
That was very good. However, in comparison with how that went, that's like a breeze. That was like a joy. That was like interviewing the Queen. In comparison with the Russell Crowe experience that was had by one Mark Lawson, the venerable Mark Lawson from BBC Radio 4's Front Row. Hello, Mark.
Hello. I'm not that venerable. I'm younger than Commode, I think. But anyway, there we go.
Oh, right. OK, well, there you go. Thank you for setting the record. It's sort of venerable. Like, venerable doesn't imply age. Does it just implies kind of noteworthy?
Oh, OK, fine. I'm
seniority.
Sorry.
That's
yeah, Mark, when he says venerable, what he means is, you know, authoritative as opposed to old. But thank you for taking it like
Hi, Mark.
That.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
Okay,
how are you?
So we've got a couple of minutes of your interview, which is terrific. Just explain, just sort of set it up for us. Just explain a little bit, Mark, and then we'll play sort of 2 minutes out of the heart.
Okay, well, I come from Yorkshire. I was at one point a cultural ambassador for the county of Yorkshire, grew up there. And I went to see this film, and I had no idea what accent Russell Crowe was doing. And they told me beforehand that the pitch of the film was he didn't come from Nottinghamshire. And I thought, well, obviously, he came from Ireland, but went on holiday to Australia occasionally. And Russell Crowe, in the interview at the Dorchester, he didn't actually say what the idea was. He just said, the idea of this film is he comes from somewhere else. And so I'm afraid I asked him, are you trying to do him as Irish?
OK, so here's just a couple of minutes from Mark Lawson's interview with Russell Crowe.
You talk about where he comes from, the location of him, the accent you've given him. There are hints to me of Irish, but what were you thinking of in those terms?
You've got dead ears, mate. You seriously got dead ears if you think that's an Irish accent.
Hints of, I thought. But,
yeah. You know, the break for him is that he has been estranged, in our version, estranged from his family for a long time. He has, you know, marched from the south of France to Palestine and back. He's seen the great empires of his time, but he's been surrounded by other Englishmen. We just took the attitude that whatever you understood about, whatever you think you know about Robin Hood, it was a previously understandable mistake. So we take some of other people's narrative ideas and we twist them around. So the name Locksley, for example, has become synonymous with Robin Hood, but we show you why that was a simple mistake to actually say that he really was this man, Locksley, you know. I'm a little dumbfounded that you could possibly find any Irish in that character. That's kind of ridiculous, but then it's your show, whatever.
So you're going for, you're going for Northern English?
No, I was going for an Italian. Yeah. Missed it?
The outlaw aspect of him, that must appeal to you at some level. I mean, there is an aspect of you that dislikes regulations, conventions.
Well, I think, you know, in the social outcast, you can, you know, you find the reality of the thought process of any given time.
Do you identify with that? But
I think that there's, you know, it's a much more complex life and therefore an interesting thing to follow, somebody who will stand outside of the social tenets of his time, yeah. But that's a broad statement.
And finally, you can either answer this or not. I just give you the chance because it's out there at the moment. As you know, that the suggestion you didn't want to say the famous line in Gladiator in this book that has come out.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't get the Irish thing, bro. I don't get it at all.
And at that stage, Mark Lawson, he's off.
At that stage, he was waving his cigarette at me, which was getting quite close to me, I felt, during the interview. He called me brother, though, which surprised me listening back. I thought it might be a word beginning with mother that he might have used at the time. So, in a way, he actually completed the interview. In fact, oddly enough, as Mark knows, as I came out of the interview, coming down in the lift, shaking, and my voice had gone completely dry, I rang Dr. Kermode. And like any good doctor, he said, these symptoms are quite common after interviewing Russell Crowe. And you really shouldn't worry about it, and it will go away. But I think, Mark, I think it was about 30 seconds after the interview completed that I spoke to you, and we shared experiences.
We did. We both sort of swapped combat stories. And it is interesting that actually he does sound really, really cross at the suggestion that his accent was Irish. But the fact of the matter is, the movie played here in Cannes, right? It opened Cannes. And the talk of the Croisette has been, what accent is Russell Crowe doing? And what's interesting is exactly funnily enough, the point that you brought up is that the accent is so all over the place that people have been asking whether it's on purpose, whether, oh, maybe he's not meant to come from there, maybe he's meant to, in the same way that Clive Barker had an accent that was somewhere between Liverpool and Los Angeles. It's like, is he in fact double bluffing us? Is he in fact doing something which is incredibly in-depth and complicated? Or is it simply that he really genuinely thinks that Robin Hood did actually actually talk like this, but every now and then he went a little bit like, you know, he'd go a little bit begorra begorra, and then occasionally he'd say ecky thop. I mean, it is the talking point of the Croisette. What accent is he doing?
It is exactly that, Mark, because he is, as you say, a serious actor. He takes it very seriously. I thought he must be doing this on purpose. He's decided that the guy had like had some kind of relative from Kilkenny or something. And it turns out it wasn't one of those ones. I think he reacted to the question because it must be at the back of his mind. He must know by now the accent hasn't worked.
Well, I just want to play you a particular speech from the film, which is a key point in the film. But Ollie in London on an email has been to see the film. As regards to the accent, it's not, as Mark Lawson, Ollie says, condescendingly described as Irish, but take it from me, a rousing speech delivered by Russell Crowe in a Geordie accent, and it creates little rousing but much giggling. Here's Russell Crowe, and I think actually maybe Ollie's onto something. Can you place this accent?
Does not bargain for the loyalty that every subject owes him. Without loyalty, there is no kingdom. There is nothing.
I'm here to speak for Sir Walter Loxley.
Speak if you must.
If you're trying to build for the future, you must set your foundations strong. The laws of this land enslave people to its king. A king who demands loyalty but offers nothing in return. I have marched from France to Palestine and back. And I know, in tyranny lies only failure. You build a country like you build a cathedral, from the ground up. Empower every man, and you will gain strength.
Would you pass us some beer, please, Father? I mean, I'm not sure, and I think it's only because he was so sensitive to it that it's actually worth discussing, because clearly if we had to do a Tasmanian accent, maybe that's particularly tricky. But I think most people from these islands will go and see that film and think, yeah, I'm not quite sure you nailed that accent.
Well, that's also the problem, Simon. Sorry, go on, Mark.
No, I was just going to say, it is worth pointing out that when you came out of the movie, Simon, you, because obviously you weren't allowed to discuss the movie because you'd signed the disclaimer, you did, however, put a tweet that said, I met a love on the way here from Sherwood, or was it Australia, or was it Ireland? I mean, everyone felt the same thing. And it looked to me like a lot of it had been post-synced, like a lot of it had been dubbed, like they'd actually gone back into the dubbing room to get to where we are now. It looked like it was done on purpose. Sorry, Mark, over to you.
Well, no, the Geordie thing is interesting, and maybe Robin's Hood relatives were Ant and Dec, because Ridley Scott is a Geordie, isn't he? I think he's from...
Yes.
They're from South Shields, and it's possible he's picked up from him. According to one newspaper, even the accent coach has said that they were trying to teach him a Nottingham accent. I don't know if that's true. So, the reason we raise it is that Crowe and Scott have made such a big deal that the origins of Robin Hood are at the heart of this remake, and that's the unique selling point. And so I think in that sense it's fair enough.
I think a lot of people will go and see it, and when Mark Addy arrives on the screen, you go, okay, that's right, that's vaguely East Midlands. I've kind of that's what he should have been doing. All he should have done is spent more time with Mark Addy.
But go on.
I was just going to say, to be fair,
Mark one and then Mark two.
Okay, you would be Mark one. Mark after you. You go first.
Well, no, in both those interviews you heard, your one and then our one on Front Row on Radio 4, he's got that bleep thing going on in his voice, which he possibly needs to see some kind of specialist about. But it's extraordinary when you hear them played back that most performers are careful on the radio, and rather commendably, perhaps. He isn't. He just says, he reacts quite honestly, which is odd for someone who's been in the public eye for so long, because most people, as we see from politicians, they learn a certain armour that they don't react honestly, and he does seem to still.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying on this subject of the problem of the accent is that actually what makes it a problem is that it's inconsistent. It's that it's as if he can't quite decide what voice to do. And the proof of this seems to me to be, OK, people have said, OK, when he's on screen with Mark Addy, well, obviously Mark Addy is doing much closer to home. But when he's on screen with Cate Blanchett is similarly Antipodean, but she has chosen a voice that she's doing. It is consistent throughout the movie. I mean, it is most significant that he's on screen for quite a long time with Max von Sydow, who is Swedish and is actually more convincing in his slightly Northern English accent. Not because Max von Sydow does a brilliant Northern English, but because he decides upon the voice and he stays with it. The thing that troubled me, I think there are other things to talk about with the movie as well, but the thing that troubled me is it sounded to me like whenever he spoke, he was struggling to decide which voice to use. That's why I say it sounded to me like bits of it were actually, they'd gone back and they dubbed lines. And I think it's impossible to pretend that it's not an issue, because an actor's voice is really, you know, it's the music of the film. And it has to have a consistency. It has to have an inner rhythm. It has to have a central recognisable tune. And I think that the fact that it doesn't is a very big problem.
Dr. Luke Bishop says, he sounds Irish to me. Crowe obviously has no idea what accent he was trying to do. As Nottingham born and bred, this outrages me, an insult to my heritage. Matthew in Suffolk, that's not Geordie. He sounds like a Scouser. Ringo, perhaps. Peter says, could not agree more about the Irish accent point. I went to see the film last night with my Irish girlfriend, who's from Derry, and we could not work out at what point in his life Robin Hood would have spent significant time in Donegal. Rod saying, yes, Dublin for me. Greg says, not a Geordie accent or a Teesside accent or anywhere that I can place in the northeast other than Irish or Scots. And John from County Cork, following the recorded interview with the good doctor last week with Russell Crowe, and having heard last night's interview with Mark Lawson, I've come to the conclusion that Russell Crowe is either A, an incredibly sensitive artist who truly cares about his performances in each and every one of his films and does not like any critic pointing out supposed flaws in performances he's put so much into, even when he is mistaken
Try it in an Irish accent, Simon. That always works well.
Or B, he just doesn't like any BBC critics called Mark. And maybe that's the problem.
Well, you know, it's impossible not to address the issue of the voice. And I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said the reason that he reacted so strongly to Mark's question is that in the back of his mind, he knows that the voice he's doing is inconsistent. Because, also, I mean, let's give him his due. The fact of the matter is, he is, in the right circumstances, a very fine actor. It's not just that he does action roles. If you look at him, for example, in movies like The Insider, in which he physically shrinks himself. He turns himself into a kind of shadowy character. He does have the talent to do that. And I think he's talented enough, therefore, to know that he's missed it as far as the vocal performance here is concerned. I think that's why he flew off the handle.
Tether Mark, Mark Lawson, would you happily interview him again, or was it a genuinely scary experience?
No, I mean, listening it back, you could hear the fear in my voice. I mean, I've had four or five occasions when people have actually walked out in the middle of an interview, including Sir Alex Ferguson, and he was actually professional in the sense that he stayed there, and he does rather heroically try to go on answering my questions afterwards, but he keeps coming back to this accent thing. I would happily talk to him again. Mark's quite right. I think he's a tremendous actor in the right circumstances. I think some of this problem, it's, as Mark and you well know, is the way that movies are shot. They're shot out of sequence over a long period, and it makes accent work very difficult, much harder than on stage, where you can get into it like a tuning fork and keep it going. And I think he just hasn't. It's a continuity error on a massive scale. He hasn't. They haven't kept track of his accent from scene to scene, I think.
And I think
that's it. I think that's absolutely it. It is a continuity error. That's exactly the point. There's no consistency of tone. If he just settled for Perth and done it all the way through the movie, he would have got away with it.
Just some final comments on this. I'm from South Shields. That sounded nothing like my accent, says Sue. Irish, Geordie, nonsense. That was John Lennon, Stuart in High Wycombe. More like Ian Paisley, says Duncan in Kingston. And Irwin, who's an Aussie in Madrid. This thing about the accents is something only you hoity-toity poms get worked up about. The rest of the world couldn't tell a Geordie from a West Country accent. Can you please move on?
But he's playing an Englishman, that's the point, so we can comment. I promise you, English actors who do American or Australian, the critics there pick them up on it, so I'm sorry.
And also, bear in mind, anyone with a London accent who's been to America has endured the Americans going, oh, I love your accent, are you from Australia? Because for some reason they think that that's what, you know, Australians sound like.
We'll do some more of your correspondence in a moment, a bit more Robin Hood. Mark Lawson, thanks very much indeed for speaking to us. Good to have you on the programme, sir.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Mark.
Mark Lawson. We'll do more with Mark Kerman, who is in Cannes. More of your emails. What else, apart from Robin Hood, should we just be anticipating,
well,
Mark?
Well, Robin Hood we're going to do as the biggie. Then we've got Lebanon, which is the four men in a tank. We have... what else is coming? Oh, yes, we have Vincere, which is an interesting movie which reveals something you might not have known, which was that Mussolini was pretty horrible to be around.
By the way, Mark Whittaker, with this for you, Mark... Here's a tagline, because we're doing taglines, making up taglines for movies. He put his wife in a pie. He had it for dinner. He doesn't regret it.
What is that?
Think Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe.
Oh, it was Hannibal. No, not Hannibal. That's not Gladiator. It's not.
Gladiator. Thank you very much.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Just thought. We'd mentioned that.
That's very good. Can we say a few words about Robin Hood other than the accent?
Take it away.
Okay. Well, okay. Because you've seen the film as well, so you know you're. I think you should be equally involved in this. Here is.
You don't mean that.
No. I say it in passing. Here is the other stuff about Robin Hood. Essentially, what you've got here is a problem of what the movie is and what it isn't. Okay. Now, the things that it's been compared to are, they've said, well, like it's Batman Begins, in that it takes the story back to its origins, back to the dark, gritty roots, that it throws out all the campery, and it, you know, it makes it darker and edgier and, you know, therefore more violent. The story is that at the very, very beginning, we see Richard the Lionheart, who is, you know, sacking towns and plundering them entirely for, you know, a bad and evil ends. He dies very, very early on. Then the Russell Crowe character ends up, well, he gets put in the stocks at the beginning, but then he ends up taking the crown back to England through a sort of convoluted route and coming back and pretending to be somebody else. So it's kind of got overtones of The Return of Martin Guerre, because he comes back and he says that he is Kate Blanchett's husband and Max von Sydow's son, in order that their family may be kept together, and also in order that he may find a place. And through doing that, he then turns into this other character, who of course actually turns out to be essentially Gladiator. So those are the three films that it clearly refers to. In all the interviews and all the talking about it, what they've said is, well, it's not Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, and it's not Robin Hood Men in Tights. And okay, it's not Robin Hood Men in Tights, that is true. And it isn't Prince of Thieves, but the fact that it isn't Prince of Thieves isn't necessarily a good thing. You see, the thing with Prince of Thieves is, I know that we're all laughing about it now and mocking it and saying, you know, wasn't it rubbish? Well, yeah, it was a silly movie.
Well, you
movie
might think
had,
that. Well, I quite enjoyed it.
No, this is what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, actually, Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, saying that the great virtue of the new Robin Hood is that it's not Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, is perhaps not in itself necessarily such a great thing. I mean, for example, okay, Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, this new version has got better hair, because we don't have the Kevin Costner feather cut issue, but we do have a poster which is essentially the same image of Robin's face with the bow, and there are certain moments of, you know, flying arrow action, which as far as I'm concerned are post Robin Hood Prince of Thieves. You can deny the heritage all you want, they are taking something from that. The second thing is that there's the joke about that we always made about Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, is that if I remember rightly, Kevin Costner, he lands on the White Cliffs of Dover, right, and then he walks the length of Hadrian's Wall in order to end up in Nottingham.
That's
right,
one.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
that's the one. Okay, fine. So we don't get that kind of geographical inaccuracy, but what we do get is the geographical inaccuracy of, you know, of Russell Crowe's voice, which does that ridiculous journey, even if his character is putting his feet in the right place. The other thing is that essentially at the heart of it, you have the same problem that they had with Prince of Thieves, which is that the dark characters, the nasty characters, in the case of, you know, Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, you have the Alan Rickman character, who has all the best lines in the movie, who famously cancels Christmas, who famously dominated the screen so much that what happened was that allegedly Kevin Costner went back into the cutting room and said, look, you've got to recut the movie to balance it out. Now, in the case of the new Robin Hood, the story is that it began originally as an idea to do a film about the sheriff, who actually ends up being a very sidelined character, and Russell Crowe was going to play that character, and then it's, no, actually what we want it to be is we want it to be a Robin Hood movie, but you're still wrestling with the fact that you've got, in the shape this time, of the character of Mark Strong, who's the guy who is negotiating the traitorous deal with the French. He actually ends up being the person who dominates the screen, and every moment that he's on, he is more interesting than Robin Hood, who is, you know, broadly speaking, the heroic gladiator character, and doesn't have, as far as I'm concerned, enough interest, enough character flaw, enough character dynamic to make him dominate the screen. And the other thing is that when Russell Crowe was on our show and he was talking to you, he was barely speaking to me, obviously, but when he was talking to you about his conversations with Billy Bragg, about, you know, the forestry decrees and about what was going on there in relation to Magna Carta, oddly enough, the conversation about all that stuff was far more interesting than seeing it portrayed on film. And what bothered me most was, since this is an interesting take on that, and, you know, it's not perhaps totally ripping the history apart, but it's taking a new look at it, and it's looking at it from a perspective which I would find attractive. Why am I not more gripped? Why am I sitting here thinking I want Mark Strong to be on screen again? Why am I thinking I want to see the French, you know, going, ah, you know, doing that, rather than actually listening to Robin doing the kind of increasingly pious stuff about sowing, you know, the seeds in the fields in the middle of the night when no one can see? And I think the problem is, in the end, that for all the things that are interesting about the movie, for all the things that are interesting about the ideas of the movie, watching the movie isn't that much fun. And say what you like about Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, it was fun.
I think it's a lot more fun than you're making out. I think people will
go... new Robin Hood is?
Yeah, the new one. Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, of course, most of what you say has a point to it, but people will go to 12A, you can take the kids, it's a good new Robin Hood film. It's got
Do you think the kids will like this movie? Because I don't think they will. I think they'll get bored. I think that what they will wonder is, you know, who am I rooting for? Which character am I most interested in? Why aren't I getting more of Mark Strong? I don't think it's going to play to that young audience.
Yeah, well, I think you're probably wrong on that. I think they'll probably like it. I think it takes it. You know, it's a 12A, so you can take pretty much anybody to it. I did wonder whether they were going to make it more gladiatorish and go to the 15 certificate, because that has never been done. If they wanted to do something that really hadn't been done before, they could make it really quite tricky and much stronger. But they didn't do that. And I think, to start with, you think, hang on, they've got the rolled-up parchment. They're telling the story, thinking, this is going to become Pythonesque. But I think by the end of it, they get away with it, and it's good fun. Anyway, shall I give you some listeners' comments?
Yes, but just
to
finish...
Oh, there are more of yours to go first.
No. Basically, one of two things will be true. I don't think the movie will perform very well at the box office. What you're saying is that you think it will. Let's take a measure on this in 3 weeks' time and see how it's done.
I think it's more fun than you're saying, than you're making it sound.
Okay, and but whereas I wouldn't usually say this, I think that in the end the proof of the pudding will be in whether or not it's a blockbuster, and I don't think it will be. Because I think, for exactly as you said, and actually you are quite right about this, because it isn't...
Twice in one programme, wow.
Yeah, exactly. Stop it. It hasn't gone the whole hog and become a 15-certificate movie. It ends up falling between two stools. It doesn't want to be Prince of Thieves, but it doesn't want to be Gladiator either. And so it ends up being Robin Hood Men in Strides, and that's not enough.
Alex Young in Cirencester just got back from watching Robin Hood. I wasn't sure what to expect of the different storyline, especially after the failure that was Alice in Underland or whatever it was, but I really, really enjoyed it. Brilliantly acted, with notable performances from the likes of Oscar Isaac as the deeply selfish Prince John, and of course the man of many talents, Mark Strong. Hello to Mark, by the way. Mr. Scott has delivered another epic in fine fashion. Dave Brickley, a long email of which this is one paragraph. Where the eternally entertaining Gladiator skillfully wove character, politics, action and romance, this waffly drivel brought to mind only Braveheart and A Knight's Tale, with the action scenes somehow increasing in scale in inverse proportion to the enjoyment they offered. To cap it all, just when the tale got where it was supposed to, the insulting final scene was presumptuous beyond belief. Peter in Berlin says, down here in Berlin, he's speaking German, and it's easily recognisable, and no one will criticise him for it. Sounds very German. He gets the dialect spot on, don't you know? Maybe he should do all his films in German, and then you wouldn't criticise him for it.
Can I just say that reference to Braveheart is spot on. There is definitely overtones that it wants to be Braveheart, but I would argue that Braveheart, which I don't like at all, is still more gripping. Even though it's total baloney, it's still more gripping baloney.
And Andy says, it's an Aussie trying to do Sean Bean, and there is a bit of the Bean there mixed in with the Oz, creating a badly integrated Tasmanian living in Barnsley. Not a good thing to meet, he says, on a Friday night out. An email from Mark Strong.
Hello, Mark Strong.
Hello, Mark Strong again. He's doing camera tests for Green Lantern. And he says this show is a connection to Blighty. Apologies again, he says, for not having seen a single film in the review section. But he enjoyed the revelation of Mark Strong, the man from Mattel, with his karate chopping arm. So hello to Mark. And he
is the finest thing about the new Robin Hood. We should also, while we're doing hellos, we should say hello to Jason Isaacs, who I think we might have neglected last week for the first time ever, which was a terrible oversight.
And to David and to Stephen and anyone else who knows us.
Us, yes.
Mr. Sheen, I don't think Mr. Sheen's been in touch. If he would like to email, we can always make way for a little bit of Sheen action on the programme. mayo@bbc.co.uk. 4:10, it occurs to me we ought to address a couple of other films, which we'll get to.
Yeah, two Israeli films are out this week. There's this Lebanon, which is, as you know, is a very highly fated one. 4 Israeli Film Academy Awards, nominated for another 5, won the Golden Lion at Venice. And the story is, it's 1982, on the first day of the war. It's seen from the perspective of a young Israeli soldier in a tank. And basically what happens is, at the very beginning, there's an outside shot, and then we are in the tank with the soldiers as they go into hostile territory. They're going in after an airstrike has happened, which has created devastation. And then the whole of the rest of the movie, the whole running time of the movie, is from inside the tank. All you see of outside is them looking down the crosshairs of the tank's guidance system, and they're trapped in this hideous environment. At one point, they take on a prisoner. All the people inside the tank are overcooked. There is on the floor, there is oil, there is water, there is urine, there is vomit. They are completely out of their depth. And it is a tough experience. I mean, the comparison which has been made, understandably so, is, in the same way as, Das Boot, it's effectively Das Tank. On the positive side, I mean, it really is a movie that sticks you in a hellish situation and gives you a sense of just how horrible that situation is. The director said that the way that he got the actors into their parts was that he got them in a big tank, which was really, really hot, shut them in it for 2 hours, and then after 2 hours banged the side of the tank really loudly to scare them, and then left them there for another 2 hours and said, okay, well, that's kind of that's what it feels like. What he said is that if you're in that environment for any period of time, what happens is you start to hallucinate, and the film does have a slightly hallucinatory quality. Inevitably, there's been a lot of question about about whether or not it's partisan, whether or not, because of course what you're getting is, you're getting essentially the view of those soldiers and the traumas that they have suffered. And some people have said, for example, it's like Oliver Stone making a movie about how hard it was to be an American soldier in Vietnam, when in fact you should be looking at the story from the other side. I mean, obviously, because the only perspective you get is from the characters inside the tank looking down the rifle, down the gun crosshairs, it is innately a movie which has only one perspective. I think actually the perspective is not partisan, because I think the depiction of what's going on is so grim, so horrible, so tough, that you'd be hard pressed to see it as just just something which is playing for sympathy. I mean, interestingly enough, the director, it's based on personal experiences, said that he made the film because he needed to make the film, partly because he needed to come to terms with the events that he remembered, partly because he needed to, in inverted commas, forgive himself. And there is there is certainly an element of that in it. I don't think it's a masterpiece. I mean, I think if you compare it to something like Waltz with Bashir, which of course was the big news at Cannes a few years ago, it's not on the same kind of artistic level as that film. But it is tough, and it is. It's occasionally rather overripe, but it does have a power, and it does have a dramatic power. And this, certainly in terms of just getting people together and putting them in a crammed environment and seeing how much you can ratchet up the tension in that, it's very fine. Also released this week is this thing called Eyes Wide Open, which is a story about... This was up for 2 Israeli Academy Awards. It's a story about 2 men in Jerusalem's devout Jewish community. One of them's a butcher, and he's taken over the butcher shop from his deceased father. One of them is a guy who comes into town who's looking for some kind of spiritual guide. He takes him under his wing, introduces him to his family. Of course, what then happens is that the men start to have a relationship, which is completely unacceptable. And the director said this. This is him quoting from his press notes. He said, the film is about experimenting or dealing with questions about sexuality. The main tragedy of this kind of life is religious people do not consider homosexuality a sin. It just does not exist. So how can you deal with it if somewhere it is written that it does not exist? And the interesting thing about the film is, I mean, again, the thing that the reference that all the critics have made is like saying, well, it's like Brokeback Mountain, but in a devout Jewish community. In fact, I thought the film had much, much more to it than that. There's an awful lot of discussion about the tangible and the intangible. An awful lot of it is to do with wrestling with issues of faith and wrestling with issues of physicality. I mean, the director said one thing, there's this central phrase, which is when you're closer to the sin, you're closer to God. And it's to do with understanding temptation and understanding that transgression, when you're in the moment of transgression, you understand that you are in some kind of system which you are aware of as you are doing it. And I thought it was a very interesting film when essentially it's a very static situation. It's a love story with two people in an environment which won't accept their relationship, and inevitably it's tragic. It also had things about it. I mean, interestingly enough, had a very, very fine musical score. The director apparently originally wanted to be a musician, and it really shows. And it's kind of haunting and elegiac, and it was a surprise to me. I was taken with it and impressed by it. Obviously, the subject matter is fairly intense. I don't think it's going to have a very wide audience. But in many ways, I think one could argue that it is a more radical and, perhaps, I think, a better movie than Lebanon, which is obviously catching everybody's attention.
So, have you seen what you think is going to be the great film of Cannes? Or do you know what is anticipated to be Le Grand film of Cannes?
Well, everyone's talking up the Ken Loach film, which is coming up, and I think everyone is really looking, because obviously the interesting thing about that was that it wasn't originally going to, it wasn't in competition, then it got pulled in at the last moment. There's a film called Beautiful, which people are sort of looking forward to. Robin Hood kicked things off in a way which may well turn out to be the touchstone for this year's Cannes, which is that, there's nothing that everyone's falling over themselves in excitement about, but there is an awful lot of excitement. There's a Mike Leigh film, which I'm seeing tomorrow, which I'm looking forward to. Tonight, I'm going to see the new Hideo Carter film, and that's not going to that's not going to set the critics alight, but something which I'm looking forward to, because I'm a big Hideo Nakata fan. But I think if you're going to be positive about Cannes, and I am trying really hard to be positive about Cannes, it is worth saying that the one thing that it does have is the ability to stumble upon something that you didn't expect because you didn't know anything about it before. It is possible in Cannes to see a movie completely without any kind of preconceptions about it, not knowing even what genre it's in, or as in the case I had yesterday, going to see totally the wrong film and seeing it by mistake. But I think that at the moment the bookies are saying Beautiful, the Ken Loach film, the Mike Leigh film are the ones that are in contention. But bear in mind, if you look back over the winners of the last 4 or 5 years, it's almost always something comes completely out of left field and totally surprises everybody. And it's rarely the film that the bookies expect to win. I mean, Cannes has a habit of being perverse, and that I think is the thing that makes it interesting. Can I just say one more thing that is out in there's this film that's coming out in the UK today, which is about Mussolini's contested first wife, and it's basically a story about this woman who falls in love with a young Mussolini, helps him, finances his newspaper, bears his first son, and for her sins is then written out of history and sent to an asylum. And I mean, it's a story that I didn't know about. I mean, the funny thing was that as critics were coming out of the screening, the general feeling was, well, hey, who knew Mussolini? He was really horrible to be around, and apparently he was really lousy to his wife as well. However, there are things in the film, and it has a sort of operatic bent to it. There are certain operatic moments that I think hark towards movies like Il Divo, and it's a more interesting telling of the story than perhaps the subject matter would sound like. It does have a kind of an overwrought sense of tragedy about it, and certainly wasn't an area that I knew anything about at all. Very fine central performance. Dramatically more interesting than I would have expected.
John in Sheffield, just a couple of points going back to our friend Mr. Crow. John says, I've just spent a week at the Holiday...
Your friend, Mr. Crow.
I've just spent a week at the Holiday Inn in Nottingham, and I can assure you that Joseph, the lovely Slovakian barman, sounds more East Midlands than the delightful Mr. Crow. John, on this email, John Ferguson, the accent... Thank you. What is that? Is that the door again?
It's the door opening, okay. But I mean, at least it's better than the large American guy shouting his reviews as if he was actually doing them down a tin can and a piece of string across the Atlantic.
John says the accent is totally obvious. He has a Geordie mother and an Irish father. He was brought up in Sligo, moved to Australia, then spent many years in Yorkshire, and then lived with his uncle in the Midlands. You can hear it all quite clearly. Yes, Dr. Clare... I was surprised and delighted to spot Dr. K featured on the front page and in a double page spread at the University of Manchester magazine. As a fellow doctoral alumnus and continued staff member at the university, I would like to congratulate Dr. K on his... What did you get? You got outstanding alumni.
Yeah, but you've got loads of them, haven't you? You get given honorary awards every day, don't you?
I want to congratulate Dr. K on this and the Sony Award, and sincerely hope the silly minstrel hat he had to wear didn't do too much damage to his... Commodian quiff.
I had worn a hat similar than that when I got my doctorate, as indeed you must have done, Simon, when you got your fake doctorate. Didn't they put a funny, you know, pie hat on your head at that point?
It looked rather jaunty. Actually, I just wore it casually on the back of my head.
I bet you would have worn it jauntily. That's the really annoying thing.
Across campus. So what is our movie of the week?
American, the Bill Hicks story.
More than Robin Hood?
Yeah.
Well, a nation...
You enjoyed that film more than I did, Simon, as is clear.
A nation is shocked. Well, I think it's Robin Hood for normal people and Bill Hicks for you, I would have thought. And a bunch of other people. But both films worthy and certainly worth seeing. Mark, thank you. Enjoy yourself in Cannes.
I'll try.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.